This is the last day of unleavened bread. So the title of this message is The Last Day of Unleavened Bread, Forward to Glory. You could ask yourself the question, why 7 days of unleavened bread? Why not eat unleavened bread all the time? Or why seven? Well, seven is the number for completion. It's one of those Bible numerology kinds of things. So it represents completely coming out of sin. And obviously God doesn't want you to say, well, 7 days of eating unleavened bread, and then after that, go back to being sinners. Of course, that's not the message. It's 7 days of unleavened bread to completely come out of the sinful world of Egypt. On the seventh day of unleavened bread, the Israelites were camped on the edge of the Red Sea. Actually, I remember from the movie The Ten Commandments, very dramatic. The old Brenner, who was a great example of probably what Pharaoh looked like and act like. The old Brenner said, well, their God may be great in his plagues, but he's a terrible general. He's led them into a perfect trap. You know, mountains on both sides, the Red Sea, and our army behind him. They can't go anywhere. You know, I'm going to get my revenge on them. If they can't be my servants, we'll just kill them and plunder them. So there they were, 7 days of wandering. They started on the first night of unleavened bread to leave Egypt. On the day, the last day of unleavened bread, they were about to leave Egypt, and Pharaoh had them trapped. By the way, when we use the terms leaven and unleavened, it makes sense. We said this in the last sermon, 1 Corinthians 5:8 shows you leaven represents wickedness. Like it pollutes the bread, puffs it up to vanity and wickedness. Unleavened bread represents purity, truth, and goodness. And that analogy, just keep that in mind. It makes more sense. So as they were there, symbolically, about to leave Egypt, going backwards was blocked because there was Pharaoh's army. They couldn't go backwards. God said, go forward. Moses thought, well, there's the Red Sea. He said, yes, use, you know, that thing I gave you. We might call it a walking stick, but they didn't call that in those days. Just use that. And in the movie, it's very dramatic. And he just did that, and the Red Sea parted. It's like opening up a zipper on a big coat. And there was the water, and I guess the east winds that night dried off the bed, and Israelites, while the Egyptian army was blocked by, you know, this pillar of fire that God was in. You know, by the way, when God led Egypt in the wilderness, he was like a cloud above them, leading the way in the daytime, that also gave them shade in the desert. At night, he was like a street light, a big pillar of fire behind them. So like camping with a big night light for you. And there he was, but real fire blocking the Egyptians. And, of course, when morning came and, the Israelites were well on their way out of Egypt, of course, Pharaoh came in. And God, of course, used that as he told Moses, I'm going to do that so we can get your total vengeance against the Egyptians for their evil. But I want to go to the metaphor for us today. We cannot go backwards, not because the army of Egypt's behind us, but because God says it would be the worst thing we could do. Let's go to 2 Peter 2:20. I want to show you that we cannot go backwards. We have to only go forward on this day of unleavened bread. It's Hebrews, James, and Peter's. 2 Peter 2:20. That we cannot go backwards. Verse 20, 2 Peter 2:20. For if after they have escaped the pollutions of the world, because the Israelites were on the last day of unleavened bread about to escape Egypt, which was one of the great sinful world empires of its day, probably number one or two at the time. For if after they have escaped the pollutions of the world through the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, they are again entangled therein and overcome. The latter end is worse for them than the beginning. For it had been better for them not to have known the way of righteousness than after they have known it to turn from the holy commandment delivered unto them. But it's happened unto them according to the true proverb, verse 22. The dog has turned to his own vomit again. You all probably seen dogs lick up their own vomit. There are a couple of animals that do that too. And a sow washed to her wallowing in the mire. And if you clean off a hog, she'll jump right back in the garbage and mud, because that's what hogs like, to wallow in the mud. But that example of wallowing in the mud is how God sees us. If you go back to the world of sin and you give up trying to go God's way, God says you would be better off to have never been called at all. So once you make that commitment, now I'm not saying this, the Bible says it. Once you make that commitment, you better go all the way. It's forward. You cannot go backwards. Just like the Egyptians were there to block Egypt, or killing the Israelites, but they couldn't go back. They had to go forward. We must go forward. We must be committed, because that's what 7 days of unleavened bread represent, the full commitment to being unleavened with God. The Israelites had a problem with trusting God. Actually, if you read the whole story, they immediately, when they heard Pharaoh's army behind them, they started murmuring, "Oh, if only we told you, Moses, not to bother us, leave us in slavery, we'd better off we had stayed in Egypt." And every time they got a test, they did the same thing. "Oh, boy, we're back in Egypt." They didn't have much faith or trust in God, or most of them didn't. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 10. I want to show you how what happened to the Israelites is appropriate for us to consider in our age, because the apostle to the Gentiles said this. Let me just give you a little background. You realize most of the Corinthians were Gentiles. That was a seaport city, so there probably were more than just Greeks there, probably Gentiles of other groups, and some Jews. You can say, well, how can Paul refer to these Gentiles as if they were Israelites? Well, when you become, so it applies to me too, when you become a Christian, a follower of Jesus Christ, you get into the bosom of Abraham and you become a spiritual Israelite. So in a spiritual sense, these words are written for us. And some of you may be the actual children of the Israelites, which may give you more to worry about, because those Israelites were stubborn. The Bible said that, not me. 1 Corinthians 10:1. Moreover, brethren, I would not that you should be ignorant, how that all our fathers, so he's including all these Gentiles in the category, were under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and were baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. Because Moses and Christ are kind of like parallels, and it's in the Bible in several places. We did all eat the same spiritual meat. We did all drink the same spiritual drink. For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. Who was the God that was in the cloud, you know, behind the Israelites at night and in front of them in the day? It was Jesus Christ. He was the rock. That's why putting the Old Testament and the New Testament like fighting against each other doesn't make sense, because the one that gave the book to Moses was the one who later, through the Holy Spirit and God the Father, became a baby in Mary's bosom and, you know, became a regular human being like us for 33 and a half years. But with many of them, meaning the Israelites, God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. You all know the story. After so many times, actually 10 times, of rubbing God's nose in their lack of faith, even the first time Moses brought the Ten Commandments down. Actually, it's a great story to read from one point of view. There's Moses with the 10 tablets in both hands, and God says to him, those people that you brought out of Egypt have turned into vileness, and they're celebrating in a very pagan and lewd manner, pagan religion. God said, they've gone astray just 40 days since they made the agreement to keep these commandments. You know, it was Moses' people, not God's people. When God was mad at them, Moses, they're the ones that you brought out. Of course, Moses reversed it and said, God, they're the ones that you brought out. It's interesting. And Moses, of course, went down the mountain, and when he saw what they were doing, he lost his temper just like God did, and he you know, threw the tablets down. And the movie is kind of spectacular. Go back to see the original Ten Commandments movie. But because of that, and they refused to go into the promised land. Well, they got right on the edge, and they rebelled. So God actually overthrew them in the desert. He said all the adults, I believe 28, age 20 was the cutoff, all the adults are going to die in the desert, except for the two good spies. And only their children go into the promised land. So they didn't make it because they lacked trust in God. They lacked faith. And they were bad. Carnal, best way to put it. They were not, I mean, their example is not a good one. Now, these things were examples to the intent that we, you know, you and I, should not lust. I'm circling the word lust in this case. After evil things as they also lusted. So if evil things represent leavened bread, for the analogy for today, think of lusting after all the bad things in the world, whatever they were, pride, vanity, well, all the bad things, you know, I want money, I want fame, I want whatever the world wants. And that's what the Israelites lusted after that, and pagan things. They lost their faith, and they didn't make it. On this last day of unleavened bread, you and I need to commit ourselves to move forward into paradise. It's like the Israelites were on their way to the promised land. We should commit ourselves forward to the promised land. Of course, our promised land is so much greater than their promised land. Let's go to Romans 8:18. I want to show you how our promised land is so much greater than theirs. And we can have a short discussion after we eat, and we can discuss all these things. You can, you know, ask questions. We can all discuss what we think will happen when we get to the promised land. But let's look at Romans 8:18. Actually, the whole chapter is probably worth reading, but let's just pick up this one verse, Romans 8:18. Paul says, I'll start in verse 17, get a little context. For if children, then heirs, heirs of God, joint heirs with Christ. Notice, we're joint heirs with Christ. He's like our elder brother, but we're going to be in the same family as Christ. Like if you were a joint heir of the Vanderbilts, of the Vanderbilt fortune. Or maybe these days it's the Gates fortune or the Zuckerman fortune. But you're going to be joint heirs with Christ that we may be also glorified together. For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared to the glory, G-L-O-R-Y, the glory which shall be revealed in us. Those, the Israelites were headed toward a physical land of milk and honey and physical prosperity, but we're headed toward glory, being a member of God's family. Like we said last week, 1 John 3:1-2, we'll see Christ as he is because we'll be like him. We'll be the same material that unapproachable light, pure spiritual energy that can never die. However you want to describe it, we're going to be, you know, lesser like than Christ, but still in the same family. Wow. Glory. We need to focus on that. Think on that. And don't get discouraged by the problems of this world, the problems of being different than the world, the problems of trying to overcome your human nature. As one famous person said, keep your eye on the prize. Keep your eye on the prize, and don't worry about the distractions that are out there. And there are a lot of distractions that are out there. Don't let the distractions get to you. We can become new members of God's family, and we can help turn this world into a physical paradise. Just think of the bad leadership that this world has now. You can see it in Eastern Europe. You know, if you were a country like Poland, which is scared spitless, or the Balkan states, and the things they see going to Eastern Europe. You know, think of poor Poland. They're in the border between Germany and Russia. They spend years being conquered by one or the other, and atrocities, and you get the general idea. But the world is full of problems. I can just open almost any continent, and I talk about the problems and the poverty and all the horrible things that go on out there. Just to mention something, we were in Texas. Of course, Texas being on the Mexican border, it's a lot of people from there in Texas. And we were just discussing at the table. I said, well, the one thing most of us know, if you were to go deep into central Mexico, but this would be true of a lot of the world. That's just the one that's closest to America. You'd see poverty like you haven't seen poverty in your life. I mean, people living in mud huts. I mean, real grinding poverty. I can understand why they're trying to get across the border. I mean, from their perspective. Of course, our government's responsibility is to protect us. But the point is, I do understand it. And we will be able to solve all these problems. And you know you won't be able to solve these problems. Foreign aid won't do it. They've been giving foreign aid for years. The UN can't do it. The UN is, they mean well, but they just, well, go ahead to that. You and I both know, not until Christ comes back, takes charge of this world, and working under great men like Daniel and Noah and Paul and David and whoever else that we don't know about, that were, you know, great Christians of the past, we'll be able to take control of this world. And of course, God will bless it too with the truth, with good government under the kingdom of Jesus Christ. We'll turn this world into a physical paradise. And you and I will have a key part. Because it says, and as we read last week in Revelation 5:10, we will rule on the earth. You know, and it says earth. It's not vague. It's very clear. And this world needs good government. Boy, we need it very badly. And eventually, everyone will be in the spiritual world. We'll be part of a spiritual paradise, which is probably so much greater we can't imagine it. And they say the universe is so big, you can't even imagine it. It takes billions of years for the light from certain solar systems to get to us. And at the speed of 186,000 miles per second? I get that mixed up. So if you think it takes billions of years of light speed, that's how far, it gives you some idea how big the universe is. Who knows what we'll do in the spirit world when God changes it. And it'll be fabulous. So when Paul says, what we have to go through now can't even be compared to the glory we're going to get. I really believe that. We need to focus on the glory. Try to stay positive. And I know there's a lot of negative things out there, and they're probably going to get worse until Christ gets back, of course. But look forward, move forward, and try to be more unleavened, more Christ-like. I'll give you the opposite example of that. Let's go to Genesis 19. I'll just give you a little bit of the background of the story. We believe that both when Abraham almost sacrificed his son, it's believed that that was also during the same part of the season. And the same with Sodom and Gomorrah was part of this season as well. God was unleavening the earth a little bit. And well, we can speculate maybe why he did it. You can ask me later. We can talk about some possible disease reasons why he may have done it. But God had heard reports about how bad Sodom and Gomorrah were. But apparently, God was not going to do anything as drastic as erasing those cities unless he checked it out himself. He and some angels went there, and the angels spent the night in the town square. And obviously, they came to the conclusion, yes, this place is as bad as the reports we're getting. But let's go to Genesis 19. We'll read verse 1 and 3 to start off. And there came two angels to Sodom at even, and Lot, who was Abraham's nephew, and that's why God rescued him, because he was his nephew, because God loved Abraham, said in the gate of Sodom, by the way, if you pray for certain key friends and relatives and children, God will rescue them because he loves you. I think you look at it that way. Lot said in the gate of Sodom, and Lot seeing them rose up to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground. So Lot did know about the true God, probably because of Abraham. And he now, this is talking to the angels who spent the night in the streets, I guess, to really check out the city, nightlife. And he pressed upon them greatly, and turned unto them and entered his house, and he made them a feast and baked them unleavened bread. Interesting, unleavened bread. Well, you all know how horrible the rest of the story goes, and they wanted to rape the angels. Going to verse 26, I'm just reading the important part of it. They were told by the angels not to look back as they escaped up into the mountains. Don't look back at these two very prosperous cities, because they're going to be destroyed. But, verse 26, but his wife looked back from behind, and she became a pillar of salt. I think the message of that story is, this world, this age as we know it, is going. And God is saying to us, don't put your thoughts and your love into this world, into the world of sin, unto the leavened world. Don't look back. Push forward with God toward becoming more godly, less worldly, less worldly, less worldly. Move forward. Don't look back. Oh, it was wonderful when I was a young bachelor and I was running wild. Don't think that way. Maybe that's a bad example. I got some young bachelors here. But you know what I mean. Don't think that way. Or young bachelorette. Don't think that way. Don't look lovingly at the world of sin. Here's one of my corny stories. It's a short one. It's called Favorite Restaurant. A young girl's parents decide to take her to visit a new church one morning. And as a small bride, they told her, well, if you go to church with us, after church, we'll take you to your favorite restaurant. So during the pastor's rather fiery sermon on the destination of the good versus the destination of evil, he asked out loud in church, and where do you think those that are pure and just and good are going to go? The little girl popped up in the back seat, and she said out loud, to my favorite restaurant, McDonald's with the playground. Well, if you've got little grandchildren, you'll understand that, because that's what they like. Well, it was a happy meal anyway. But really, we should look forward to that reward on this last day of unleavened bread when Israelites crossed the Red Sea and left sinful Egypt. We should leave this world, leave our own personal sins, fight them, resist them, move forward, to true godliness and true unleavened religion. By the way, you know, it's often in war, the one that wins, although obviously many factors affect winning, but often the one that wins is the army that moves forward in crucial times. Like it was a story where General Patton didn't have orders to cross the Rhine River, and he couldn't get them, and maybe there are all kinds of reasons why. But all of a sudden, the Germans left, one of the bridges was not blown up. We actually think some of the Germans may have done it intentionally so more of them could be captured by the Americans and the Russians. If you know how the Russians treated prisoners, you'd understand that logic. But whether they did intentionally, their efforts to blow up the bridge failed. This major bridge over the Rhine River, because it takes a while to get tanks and equipment and supplies over a big river, like crossing the Mississippi, say, south of Cairo. That's really wide and difficult. Patton said, I'm not going to wait for order. He told his subordinate generals, on my authority, seize the bridge, cross the river. And, of course, that had a lot to do with winning the war or shortening the war. And probably if they listened to him more, they maybe could have shortened it even faster, according to one of my instructors in ROTC. But moving forward sometimes makes a difference, a crucial moment. Don't stand behind. Also, if you think, well, I will do nothing. Doing nothing is a decision. It's often a bad decision. You're immobile. I think you're more a victim for Satan. I'm just not going to do anything. I'll wait a couple years and think about it. Move forward on these days of unleavened bread. Let's look at the true meaning of unleavened religion versus leaven. Let's go to Matthew 23:23. Look at the true meaning. Matthew 23:23. Actually, Patton got so insubordinate, they had to short his supplies to slow him down because he's... But that's... I'm not saying he was right. There's room for debate there, I guess. Matthew 23:23. here's what Christ... By the way, you might remember we read this earlier in Matthew 16:4-12. Christ told his disciples that the leaven of the Pharisees, referring to their doctrine, their policies, and their bad behavior, was part of the leaven, unleavened analogy. And he said, don't follow the leaven or the sinfulness of the Pharisees. So let's look at Matthew 23:23, where Christ really tells the Pharisees really how leavened they are, how evil they are. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint, anise, and cumin. That means they counted little mint leaves and tea leaves in their garden so they could bundle them up, be sure they paid a tithe out of every mint leaf. And you can imagine how proud they were. I tithe with such punctilious accuracy that God is happy that I'm on his side. God needs me. You can imagine how puffed up they were. I'm trying to puff myself up. You get an idea of probably how they felt about themselves. And have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, faith. These ought you to have done and not leave the other undone. In other words, he's not saying they shouldn't have tithed or even some of the more ritualistic, smaller things. He's not saying they shouldn't have done that. But he's saying, but you didn't do the most important things, the real essence of unleavened religion, the real essence of worshiping God. Your emphasis is all wrong. It should be on judgment, mercy, and faith. Verse 24, you blind guides which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. Just think of that analogy. By the way, some of the Pharisees wore a little mesh over their mouth and went to the marketplace because there were bugs in the marketplace, and they didn't want to accidentally swallow a gnat. I'm not making this up. Some put little strainers over the water they strained before they drank it. Because who was to say some little tiny bug might get in there and contaminate the pure essence of this Pharisee? They went and they were punctilious about other things. And yet, their judgment was perverted. Christ said that. Their policies for which they ruled the Jewish people were evil and a burden. By the way, they also exempted themselves from some of their more burdensome policies. Does that remind you of anything you've heard of? We'll pass a law for you all, but anyway, they were bad news and self-righteous. And even when they did use God's law, because they did believe in the Bible, give them their credit, but even when they did use God's law, they emphasized petty details while ignoring the big overall behavior of what they should have done. And yet in their heart, and if you read most of the Gospels, you will clearly see even the Roman governor, when he was about to crucify Christ, he washed his hands, Pilate said, because it actually says he knew that the Pharisees really wanted to kill Christ over envy, because he was doing great miracles, was preaching with power and authority. The mobs followed him in ways that they never followed them. You could just imagine them as green with envy. And it was clear to Pilate, that's why they're after him, that he wasn't bad. They were just green with envy. They were full of hate and envy, the very opposite of Christian love. You could say the Pharisees were the poster child for being leavened. Make sure I get that right. It's easy to screw up at my age. Leavened, full of puffed up vanity. That's what they were full of. So how should we be unleavened? Let's go to 1 Corinthians 13. This is just one verse, but maybe, you know, when you read all of 1 Corinthians 13, Paul basically, it's called a love chapter. He says the real essence of Christianity is love. Let me just read a few verses, and we'll get to the essence of it. But 1 Corinthians 13, Paul says, and certainly the Pharisees needed to know this, For though I speak with the tongues of men and angels and have not charity, and that word is agape, it means Christian love or godly love or more objective love, be a better way of looking at it. The reason the King James translators use the word charity, because they wanted to differentiate it from romantic love. But because they use that word, now we have tons of charities, you know, like the Salvation Army and March of Dimes. And I'm saying it's wrong for them to call themselves charities. They're doing godly charity. But when we see the word charity, we don't think of godly love, objective love. But that's really what the word was originally meant when the King James translators translated it. So I have not love. I've become as a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal, just noise and thunder. That's what the Pharisee, they were all religious noise, but no real depth or meaning, all just religious noise. And though I have the gift of prophecy, and that means, you know, speaking the truth, and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I can remove mountains and have not objective godly love, I am nothing. So that's what God says. Love is a big thing. Now, going to the end of the chapter, verse 13, he kind of summarizes it. Verse 13, 1 Corinthians 13. And now abideth faith, hope, and charity, or godly love. These three, but the greatest of these is love. So if you just take those two verses alone, you can see the really core of being unleavened, the core of being godly or unleavened, things like faith, which the Israelites didn't have, trusting God, having hope. You believe that God has a great reward for us. You have hope in that, and that hope floats. They say hope floats. Hope keeps you going. Judgment. Judgment is wisdom. And wisdom comes from, I think, understanding the Bible correctly, and God's wisdom is in the Bible. If we can improve our Bible IQ, we should be able to improve our wisdom and wouldn't be doing the stupid things the Pharisees did. Most of all, love. And understanding how to love God and how to love your fellow man. It's not always as obvious as it seems as well. Sometimes love is tough love. Sometimes you have to say to someone, well, you know, if I give you this stuff, I actually have had it happen to me, and I wish I had not done it. You're going to take it and get drunk, and then your life is going to spiral out of control. Oh, well. But learning how to have Christian love. Also, the Pharisees couldn't see the signs of the times. Let's go to Luke 12, and that's part of godly wisdom and judgment. You know, mentions judgments. Well, let's go to Luke 12:56, because part of judgment, one of the key things that God wants us to get is understanding the sign of the times. Luke 12:56. Luke 12:56, Christ says, "You hypocrites." That was his almost favorite term for them. He often called them vipers or snakes in the grass. "You hypocrites." By the way, they learned never to debate him. They asked him real tricky Bible questions to embarrass him in front of the crowds. He always turned the table on them, and they end up being embarrassed. They learned, this guy knows more than we do. We don't know where he got his wisdom from, but they learned not to ask any more questions because it backfired on them. You can imagine their envy went up like 15 more levels. Anyway, he says, "You hypocrites, you can discern the face of the sky and of the earth, but how is it you do not discern the times?" And the time that they lived in was the first coming of the Messiah. There were all kinds of prophecies that they knew that pointed to, well, his virgin birth, but actually there are about 109 Old Testament prophecies that related to Christ. Quite a few had already transpired, and maybe God allowed them not to understand it somewhat because God wanted him to die. But even still, I think Christ felt their opposition to him was beyond what it should have been. They should have recognized the signs of the times, and they didn't see it. They didn't get it. You know, with all the miracles he did, raising people from the dead, you would think somebody would have said, wait a minute. You sure we want to go after this guy? I mean, you'd almost have to, someone hit you upside the head. Can't you see that God is with him? Now, some of the Pharisees, some of the younger ones, I think less ranking ones, did convert to Christianity, we know from later. But a lot of their leaders, apparently, they didn't get it. I want to ask the same question of you and me. Do we see the signs of the times? I think I can feel the times. I remember when I was a kid, and not that the world was great back then, but I remember the 50s and 60s. I'm older than I look. That used to get great laughs. Anyway, the world was different then. We could stay out as a 9 and 10-year-old kid. You could stay out at night at 10 o'clock. Nobody ever heard of children being, well, you were just safe. There were a few bad kids you had to worry about, but it wasn't anything like the gangs of today. The world was more peaceful. Most people believed in the Bible. I'm not saying that everything was perfect, but the world was just more, the world was more peaceful, more patriotic. Families were more intact. It is just, and I look at the world as it is now, and I see, it's like a, you know, toilet going down the drain. You feel, you can sense things going downhill, can't you? I can just sense it. I can feel it. I realize we still have some more big prophetic events yet to come. So Christ is not going to come back in the next 2 or 3 years, but it's not all that far away. I can even look at Europe, and I can, and this is my opinion, of course, but I'm giving you my opinion. If Putin is strutting around threatening countries in Eastern Europe, and he'll probably get away with a good deal of it, probably. If I were a European and I said, well, who's our greatest leader? And it's Angela Merkel. And I'm not putting her down. She's probably a good technocrat. I think that's the appropriate word. And she's done a good job with Germany's finances. I'd be wanting a European strongman. Or they will soon start wanting one. And, you know, all the financial problems that are out there, you know the financial bubble in Europe and America is going to burst someday. Well, if you don't know it, that's my opinion at least. And when it happens, the world's going to reach out for the strong man in Europe, and it's going to happen. The last evil empire will come. I can just sense it. And I can sense America's getting weaker. Now, maybe the details, we don't know how long it will take, we don't know. But I can sense that we're living in those times. And the future leader, who's called the beast in Europe, a ten-headed revival of the Holy Roman Empire of some sort is coming. And, you know, I'd say less than 7, 8, 9, 10 years away. I could be wrong, could be a little further. Then you think about Revelation 18:4, where the angel tells the people, get out of Babylon the Great before God destroys it. Can you see that Babylon the Great is going to come in Europe somewhere in the next 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years? I can feel it. I can sense the times. Now, maybe that my timing will be off a little bit one way or the other, but I can sense it's coming. The church is kind of in a lull period, and maybe we're waiting for one of the two witnesses to come. That's my opinion, but we will see. Only God knows the exact details and the timing. But I would say our job is to get unleavened before Babylon the Great comes, so we can be in a place of safety. We won't have to prove that we're willing to come out of the world. Let's do it now. Let's get unleavened now. Symbolically, when you become unleavened, as we're unleavened right now, we're symbolically leaving Egypt or Satan's world by becoming eating unleavened bread today. We're leaving, well, the future great Babylon is going to put it all together in the future. And by eating unleavened bread, we have left, or in the process of leaving, the Babylonish religion empire that will someday ride the beast. So bite that unleavened bread with hope. It is maybe our symbol of safety and freedom. So how can we become more unleavened? Now I'm going to switch, as we get to the end of this message, I'm going to switch to the how and not so much the symbolic why. And in the discussion after this, if you have other suggestions on how, feel free to share it with us. Okay, how to become more unleavened. How to be a purer Christian. A purer Christian. My number one thought, and I'll admit I got a lot of these ideas from reading other people's material. So, but there's nothing new there, right? You learn from wherever you can find it. So they're not original of me. But number one, think about our future goal. Think about the glory that's yet to be had. Think about being in God's family. Think about being an infant God, getting into that family. And we should encourage each other about the future and what lies ahead. Maybe we'll someday go and rebuild a whole new planet just for dolphins or turtles. I don't know, maybe something more dramatic than that. But whatever, you know, the God family decides in the future. Of course, we'll have Jesus Christ and all those great angels and all those previous saints to help us. But think about the future and let that, our eye being on the prize, let that inspire and guide us. And don't get too negative as we see the cloud of darkness go in Europe. By the way, I think it was my wife who found this quote, but somebody did. Whenever anti-Semitism grows, evil grows. And you can trace that historically, the 1930s and 40s, you know, in Central Europe. By the way, do you notice last week, one of the paramilitary groups stirring up trouble in eastern Ukraine told the Jews of one city outside the synagogue, gave them leaflets, all Jews must register. The Jewish people, going through several pogroms, they know what that means. It is not good, by the way. It is not good. It is pure evil. And actually, one time they had to wear all yellow, or in Hitler's day, they had to wear a big yellow star with a J, but in German, that means Jewish. I think it was a big J, or Y, or something like that. Anyway, they know what that means. That is pure evil. And we now see it rearing its head in Europe. Now, it's just one part of Europe at the moment. But you know how these things tend to spread, don't you? You see that evil, the same thing existed before the Third Reich. Maybe a Fourth Reich is coming. But according to prophecy, this guy will be bigger, better, more dangerous than Adolf Hitler ever was, at least for just a few years. But he's coming. So as you see evil coming, don't get discouraged. Keep our eyes up and on the prize. Number two, value Bible study. Put it high on your priority list. How can we improve our judgment and wisdom? Because that's one of the things that was mentioned as pure religion. We can improve it by knowledge of God and our understanding of God and understanding of His love and why He made certain decisions. And let's face it, the Bible is not easy to understand, or everybody would understand it. I mean, some things are easy, but some things take a little bit of study, background, understanding, context. But come to church on a regular basis and we'll all learn together. We'll grow together in Bible knowledge. Like that expression in Hebrews, iron sharpens iron. Let us sharpen each other and up our Bible IQ. And I think we've learned a lot in the last 2 or 3 years. Don't you feel we've learned a lot more about the Bible the last 2 years than we used to know? I mean, it's not that we've changed doctrine. I think we just see it more complete and deeper. At least I hope you all feel that way. I feel that way. We're learning it better. Number three, pray and ask God for guidance. Put prayer in your high priority list to try to pray every day. And as we said before, I know the human nature resists praying, and you know, nobody wants to pray because it's just not natural and normal. But force yourself to pray. I pray with prayer lists, but sometimes without them. But pray and ask God, what do you want us to do? And ask God what He wants for each of us. And ask Him to open your mind so you can understand things better, make wiser decisions, have more godly love. And, of course, ask Him for whatever you want to ask Him for as well, and for His will as well. This is kind of point three and a half. It's kind of with prayer, but a little different. Pray, ask God to help make us able to make wiser decisions. I've made so many bad decisions in my life. I almost wish I could go back the last 40-some years and do it all over again, but I won't do that. I might screw it up worse. You never know. But you have that thought. When you reflect back on your life, you're like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. I should have been more this way. I should have. But help ask God to help us make wiser decisions from here on out in our prayer. Pray for God's help. Also pray for God's work that we can reach people. Even though the church is small and scattered, and I have to assume God is allowing that for a few more years for whatever his purposes are, even in that context, still ask God to help us make impact. And I'll tell you about some of the things we discussed at Tyler we may want to try this year, but help us make more impact, even though maybe God's not going to catapult the truth to the world's attention just yet. And ask God to help us be ready to leave the world, to leave this world and its sinful ways, and go to the true religion and say, yes, Lord. And remember this, it was easier to get the Israelites out of Egypt than to get Egypt out of the Israelites. Well, isn't that true of us too? It's easier for you to walk in the door, like one man said, going into a garage no more makes you a car than your walking in the church makes you a Christian. Actually, it was a famous Christian who said that. But, you know, there's a certain point. You got to ask God to help us change from the inside out, because that's what really counts, to really truly be unleavened. And commit to being unleavened and pure Christian.